foes, they're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group, since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace. Was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think. They say code terror,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink to hunger.
Was Code Pink by Emma's Revolution. I'm Jasmine, the member and youth coordinator here at Code Pink, and welcome to our Code Pink radio show presented by WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and many other community radio stations like Western Mass Community Broadcasting, WMCBLP 107.9 FM. We're also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and you can check us out on our website at codepink.org/radio, where you will find all of our episodes, from episode one to our most recent. This past Sunday, the Ramadan moon was spotted over Saudi Arabia, marking the beginning of Ramadan 2024 for billions of people worldwide. In a normal year of occupation, Israel has been known to ramp up its violence during the holy month to crush the spirits of the Palestinian Muslim population. This year, after more than 5 months of this latest genocidal campaign, we expect no different. Palestine solidarity organizers around the world are figuring out how we can increase the pressure even more so that not another Ramadan in Palestine is spent under occupation. This week, we're taking action by asking our congressional reps to pledge to vote no on any supplemental funding to Israel. You can find out more at copink.org/congresstracker. So today, we're diving into Palestine solidarity work, general anti-imperialist organizing, and the discipline this work requires of us. I'm joined by organizer from the Dallas Anti-War Committee, Tamara Lene, who has lots of wisdom to share on what it means to step up in this moment and be disciplined in our organizing. Thanks so much for joining us, Tamara.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So we're going to jump right in here, right? Both of us are currently organizing in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but we have, you know, both long and complex and varied experiences with anti-war organizing and deepening our politic here. But I'd love to ask you, what have you learned about discipline and solidarity, specifically from Palestine solidarity organizing?
Yeah, well, thank you for that question. I think one thing that has stood out to me and that I have been sitting with, I would say for the past several months is, I have been organizing for about 5 to 7 years now, and I've done a lot of work around, I would say, combating police state violence in the carceral system. I've done a lot around, when it pertains to Black Lives Matter. But I feel like when it comes to Palestine organizing, I feel I have truly learned what it means to be in solidarity when it comes to being a global citizen. When it comes to, internationalism, I feel like I have truly learned what it means to be an ally. Even though I am a biracial Black woman, I also understand that I live in the belly of the beast, that I live under an imperial colonial empire. And with that comes my own privileges. And though I do face my own oppressions, I am learning that as a result of, living in the US, that I have a moral responsibility and duty to do something about that. And so I feel like that is one thing I've learned, working on the ground here in Dallas-Fort Worth, not only with you, but with Palestinian organizers. I feel like that has really allowed me to also recognize some of my own blind spots as an organizer. And I've been very much grateful for that.
Yeah, I love that a lot, talking about us as global citizens, right? That leads really great into this next question of, we're talking this week about discipline and commitment, right? So what does solidarity demand of you in this moment? What have you learned to give up or adjust to, right? What is being a global citizen, being someone who is in solidarity with oppressed people worldwide? What does that demand of you?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is being more of a conscious consumer. I never really thought, I would say, more intentionally about what I buy, what I'm consuming, because again, we live in the belly of the beast and we've been so inundated with materialism, consumerism, and rooted in this context of being an individual instead of a collective. And so I think we're all in it, learning is continuous, learning how to decolonize what we've been socialized to believe growing up in this westernized society. So I feel, as I'm learning more about boycotts and divestment, that it's teaching me how to be more in solidarity with Palestine organizing. So, I'm educating myself on, what products am I buying? What do these companies stand for? And is it in alignment, what as a collective, as a movement, what we're currently fighting for? And if it's not, then again, it goes back to responsibility. It goes back to solidarity that it takes an act of courage, and this is also part of the work of liberation to choose not to buy those products and to educate others on why. And so I feel for me, that's something that I've been demanding of myself and also demanding of others. But that comes with also political education. A lot of us don't know. I mean, it's not just even about Palestine, it's about, even the Congo, right now I'm having this interview on my MacBook, and it's I'm learning so much as part of being part of this movement and understanding, what it means to be a conscious buyer. So instead of, buying the newest iPhone, hold on to that iPhone for as long as you can. And also advocate for policies or laws that are going to, again, combat, I'm sorry, that are going to combat this exploitation of countries that have been under-resourced because, again, colonialism and imperialism.
Yeah, I think you covered so much. I especially love this focus of consumerism because for so long, it's like you said, especially for those of us, the United States in the belly of the beast, our lifestyles that are based around consumerism and distraction are what, are directly enabled by the violence happening elsewhere, right? So the least we can do is kind of reflect on our individual buying power and consumerist habits to make sure that we're not literally investing in, violent and more criminal technology, right? But I think that there's also a question so many folks are having right now about the other end of the spectrum of like the collective action necessary to really shift change right now. So I'd love to hear from you, how do we build the trust and capacity necessary for sustained action? right? A lot of folks who have been waking up to this kind of work in recent months are feeling energized. They feel bamboozled and like they've been lied to, and they're coming awake and they're ready to kind of jump in to the deep end of, let's shut things down. And we absolutely want that energy. We want folks to do that work. But as organizers, we know that it takes time, takes trust, it takes discipline, right? So I'd love to hear from you. How do we build that trust and that capacity necessary for sustained action?
Yeah, well, I think it really comes down to relationship building. Again, we've been so ingrained in individualism, and we've been trained to not see outside of ourselves. And I feel like that is the work of abolition, of resistance and liberation is community care and collectivism. Relationship building takes time. And I think that also comes down to connecting with different groups or organizations that people feel might be in alignment with, their own beliefs and ideology. I can just say from experience, from the groups I have been involved in, it truly came down to me just showing up to protests and just started talking to people. Getting connected with them and, going to one of their meetings to get more of a sense of what these people and the group that they're affiliated with stand for. And that was my way of getting more involved. And then over time, as that becomes more consistent, and you continue building that trust with those people, with that comes a bit more responsibility where, those individuals may ask you to step up and take on some more tasks, whether that's helping to plan, certain actions and helping to maybe bring in other people that are trying to find, their own hub. I know with that also comes security risks. And I think this time, especially with this movement, we're learning a lot about security culture. And we know historically, throughout time, tactics that have been used to dismantle movements or cause infiltration. So I think with also building trust and capacity with individuals is honestly vetting them as well, looking at, their past history, who they've been affiliated with, what they have done in their past. And I think that is also part of relationship building because as me and when it comes to on the ground organizing, sometimes that also requires direct actions. And that requires placing a lot of trust in individuals that you're doing that with, hoping they will have your back. I'm just speaking from my own experience. And then just also offering, I would say, as somebody that has been an organizer for several years, and you're bringing in a lot of newer organizers that are starting from scratch, offering them that mentorship and holding space for their ideas, their opinions, because they are valid. While also, I think when it comes to movement building as well, a big key component that I think a lot of people still have a hard time implementing is accountability, conflict resolution, holding each other accountable if we have caused harm in our own communities to sustain the movement and sustain our community. And I think that's really important. I'll stop there.
No, you're touching on so many phenomenal things. I think you're absolutely right. In this moment, every time someone comes to me and is asking, I'm ready to get started. What do? I always say, go find your people, right? The sooner you go from being one person who feels like you have all this awareness and the weight of the world and changes on your shoulders to being in community, right? With trusted others to whom you're committed to and to whom you're growing with, it makes a world of difference. And you go sooner from being within the capacity of what can I do as one person to like what can we accomplish together, right? And you become so much more expansive. And yeah, that really requires like the long, slow work of relationship building, right? A lot of organizing isn't just mobilizing organizing and showing up, right? It's not just being a body at a protest. So much of it is also showing up for all those meetings in between, those long hours, the canvassing, the relationship building, right? There's so much that goes into that. So I'd love to kind of ask you here, what other advice or lessons might you have for new organizers, folks who are radicalizing in this moment, right? So many of us can reflect on when we first started coming into consciousness, when we first started systems thinking and making connections and seeing beyond our individual experiences, right? We know that could be overwhelming, and folks are figuring out how to wade through that overwhelmingness, right? But are also finding their way into organizations for the first time, formations for the first time. We saw back in 2020 how so many mutual aid formations popped up for the first time, right? Folks who had never done that work recognized the need and was like, hey, we'll figure it out together. And the way that was so successful was because there were so many existing groups already who were able to share information and help us not to reinvent the wheel, right? So for those of us who have been organizing for a few years now, who've been in the Palestine Solidarity Movement for a few years now and have learned some things, you know, what advice might you have for folks who are, like I said, starting anti-imperialist organizing and solidarity work, and again, are trying to sustain themselves, go at the pace of trust, but also the pace of urgency that the moment allows? We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, well, I would say a couple things. One is that, you know, we're all only human. And, you know, when it comes to being a newer organizer, I think a lot of times, and I can also speak from my own experience when I started out organizing, is that we tend to be so ingrained in like the perfectionism, and I want newer organizers to understand that sometimes you're gonna make mistakes, or sometimes you're gonna say something like, oh, I shouldn't have probably said that or worded it that way. But again, that's what's part of being in community, is having those tough and uncomfortable conversations to continue growing and mobilizing and sustaining our movement. There have definitely been times throughout my years of organizing where I've had to be checked. And I'm grateful for those people that have checked me, because it made me see something that I wasn't seeing because, again, of my own privileges. We all have blind spots, and that's just part of being human. That's part of the systems we've grown up under, how we've been socialized, and that's part of the work of decolonization. I will also say that I also want newer organizers to understand that this is a marathon. This is not a sprint. And I know when I first got into organizing, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, we're going to make such big change so quickly. And I realized, no, we are up against some big, violent systems, and small wins are huge. And this work is for a lifetime. And it's not easy, and it's rewarding, but I think back to the Marian Kaba, you know, hope is a discipline, and you truly do have to hold on to that, because, you know, again, I think newer organizers going with this idealism, and, you know, don't lose that, but we also have to think strategically, and we have to go about certain tactics in various ways. And we also have to go back to the drawing board a lot of the times to re-strategize. And this is just part of the work, because we understand that we are up against certain systems that are going to continue repressing us and oppressing us. And we have to lean on each other to continue maintaining that hope and fighting.
Yeah, I think those are phenomenal words to close us out with. I've been thinking a lot about this lately. I love that you brought up the Marian Kaba quote. I feel like I write that in my journal at least once a week, right? The reminder that hope is a discipline. I feel like discipline is one of the key words of 2024 when Palestinians and folks in Sudan and the Congo and elsewhere are demanding so much more of us, because it's about time that those of us in the belly of the beast step up to the plate and really fulfill our responsibility to help break down this empire. So we really appreciate these lessons and reminders that relationships are at the base of organizing, but so is reflection, right? We have to be making sure that we're learning together all the time. We're deepening our analysis. We're deepening our, you know, alignment with each other, and we're seeing what's working and what's not working, right? So many folks are being activated in this moment because they say, I've been going to protest for years and I haven't seen any change in my community. Well, are you actually working with those in your community, or are you just showing up? Right. So I really appreciate these lessons around no one can really offer a step-by-step guide of how to organize your community, but the reminders you've offered today, Tamara, are super insightful. And I hope new organizers and those with lots of experience learn something from you. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
To our listeners, you can follow Tamara's work at thutch25 on Instagram, and you can also find their organization, Dallas Anti-War Committee, on Instagram. You are listening to Code Pink Radio, coming to you through Pacifica Radio's WPFW in Washington, D.C., WBAI in New York City, KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. We will be back after this break with Noor, Code Pink's phenomenal Palestine campaigner. Was Omar with Stop War, Make Love, a classic Black British anti-war anthem that's as relevant as ever. Welcome back. I'm Jasmine, the member and youth coordinator at Code Pink. You are listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. Next, we'll hear from Noor, Code Pink's Palestine campaigner, on anti-imperialist feminism as central to
Hi,
Women's
everyone.
Month.
My name is Noor, and I'm the Palestine campaigner with the feminist anti-imperialist group Code Pink. And I always make sure to emphasize that anti-imperialist part because I think it's really important. And I think that too many times feminism is co-opted by the West, and too many times the oppressor uses feminism to advance their capitalist and imperialist goals. We saw it after October 7th when lies were spread about mass rape. And we see it in political figures like Joe Biden, who use International Women's Day as an opportunity to gain social favor and to talk about things like reproductive justice. And, you know, we watch him pathetically pretend to care about these things, when in reality, he supports a genocide campaign that is stripping women in Gaza of their right to reproductive health care. And not only of their right to reproductive health care, but of every single one of their rights, including their right to life. We recognize this hypocrisy that's inherent to feminism that lacks intersectionality, and we reject it with every fiber of our being. Women of the world, especially the women of Palestine, Sudan, and the Congo, today I want us to ignore the colonizer. I want us to ignore the lies that have perpetuated our oppression for decades. The lies that say we're oppressed by our own people and that we're victims of our own culture. The lies that say that capitalism and terrorism by the West is actually the key to our empowerment. When the reality is that it's been our commitment to our people and our culture that has allowed us to survive thus far. When in reality, in organizing spaces, when I look around, it's dominated by women doing the hard work to liberate us all. Women that have mentored me to even be able to be standing here today. And of course, above all, I'd be amiss if I don't mention my own Palestinian mother, who raised 5 strong Palestinian women and a Palestinian man, all on her own. So we will no longer allow International Women's Day to be about the oppressor. We'll no longer allow them to decide what's best for us, because we could do that on our own. I call on every woman, to stand strong against oppression in solidarity with one another. Because that's where our power is at. We are the backbone for the liberation and for our people, and that will continue to be true no matter what lies our oppressors spread about us. That's where our focus must be, on mobilizing our people to fight back against colonialism like our ancestors have done. Like our ancestors have passed on to us, that power. It's time that we harness it and we use it to advance to the liberation of women everywhere, from Palestine to Congo to Sudan to here in the United States. And that starts with a permanent ceasefire in Gaza and an end to all USA to Israel, and a step further after that, a complete and total end to Israel's occupation in Palestine. From the river to the sea!
From the river to the sea!
Palestine will be free!
Palestine will be free!
From the sea to the river!
From the sea to the river!
Palestine will live forever!
Palestine will live forever!
Thank you, everybody.
Next up, we'll hear from Code Pink co-founder Jody Evans on hyper-imperialism.
My name is Vijay Prashad. I'm speaking to you in my capacity as a member of the group No Cold War, which is an international platform which was set up a few years ago around a statement. You can read the statement at nocoldwar.org. It's an important statement because we came out a few years ago just to say we want more collaboration in the world and less confrontation. We think that the new Cold War imposed by the United States on Eurasia, particularly on China, is raising the temperature of world affairs. And rather than have people collaborate to solve the basic problems of humanity, the dilemmas of humanity, rather than that, we have people increasing military spending, pushing the confrontation of human differences into war. We've seen, since we put forward the No Cold War statement, we've seen war break out in Ukraine, direct shooting war. We've seen this terrible genocidal war against the Palestinian people in Gaza, but also, of course, the war continuing against the Palestinian people in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem. Horrible, unbelievable violence against people who cannot flee anywhere and are dying of starvation now, apart from the bombs. I often tell people war leads to long-term traumas because you don't understand what the war zone is like. It's noisy, it's dusty, it's filled with toxic substances because we build our buildings with a lot of toxic metals and chemicals. And when you blow up a building, you send into the air ghastly substances that destroy the lungs of little children and damage them for their entire lives. This is not just a war where 30,000 Palestinians have been killed. This is a genocidal attack on 2.3 million people who live in Gaza, 2.3 million Palestinians. Over 100 years ago, Lenin wrote a compelling and important pamphlet called Imperialism. He published that pamphlet at a time when there were inter-imperialist conflicts in Europe that led to the First World War, the Great War, as it was called then. The inter-imperialist conflicts took place mainly in Europe, where different imperial powers were jockeying for influence and control over the rest of the world. That period of inter-imperialist conflict came to a close, in a sense, after World War II, when we entered a new period, when a different kind of international geography took hold. There were principally three blocks in the world in the immediate aftermath of World War II. The West, the imperialist West on the one side, the socialist camp on the other, and the Third World. And you entered into a period where inter-imperialist conflicts didn't seem to drive the contradictions of world history. With the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, we entered a third period when there was a kind of unipolarity imposed by the United States on the rest of the world. That period came to a close and we entered a fourth era, a period that opens up with the Third Great Depression from 2008, when new entities emerged: China, Russia, India, Indonesia, South Africa, Brazil, and so on, to take space from that unipolar moment and to contest unipolarity. It is in this context, the fourth phase since Lenin's imperialism, that we are calling hyper-imperialism. It's a very important text. It's freely downloadable from the Tricontinental website in at least Spanish, Portuguese, and English. Other languages will be up in time. I highly recommend that people look at it. It's 186 pages long. It's filled with a great deal of data and of interest. Well, very happy to move this along. It's a pleasure for me to invite now Rania Khalek, who is a journalist based in Beirut, Lebanon. Rania has a number of shows on Breakthrough News. If you don't watch Breakthrough News, I recommend you do. There's some terrific programs at Breakthrough. Her programs are terrific. She has a show called Dispatches. She travels all around the world, recently interviewed a leader of Ansar Allah in Yemen, giving his own view as the Yemeni government sees it regarding what's happening in Palestine. A very important journalist that you are, Rania. Your other show is The Freedom Side with your host, Eugene Poirier. And I'm sure you'll be happy to know that Eugene is watching you now as you join us to present on hyperimperialism. Rania, take it away.
Well, hello, Eugene. And thank you for that lovely introduction. And also thank you for inviting me to participate. It's really an honor to speak alongside such a stellar cast of incredibly smart people. I'm talking to you, like Vijay mentioned earlier, from Beirut, Lebanon, where every day we hear Israeli threats of genocide, that they plan to take us back to the Stone Age, that they want to copy-paste Gaza onto Lebanon. But they haven't been able to do that yet because Lebanon has a very strong resistance. But since I'm here, I'm going to focus mostly on Gaza. And I think, in this moment of hyper-imperialism, of this imperialism on steroids, of this era that we're in, this hyper-imperialism seeks to destroy and punish anyone who refuses to submit to the current order. And the imperialists are willing to carry out a genocide as punishment. What Western governments have called Israel's right to self-defense, as I'm sure everybody on this call knows, has so far resulted in the murder of over 30,000 Palestinians, overwhelmingly civilians and overwhelmingly children. And we're all watching as Israeli society openly celebrates its crimes. They're proudly posting their genocide to social media. We're witnessing nothing short of a live-streamed Holocaust against the Palestinians of Gaza. And it's all supported by the collective West, and that egomaniacal, callous behavior of Israeli society is, I think, a reflection of what the imperialist West truly stands for. And, as Israel's genocide in Gaza reaches new heights of cruelty, many are wondering why Western regimes who claim to be these leaders of the free and civilized and lawful world are enthusiastically supporting this belligerent annihilation in Gaza, it seems kind of like they've gone crazy. You know, they're willing to destroy the so-called rules-based order they worked so hard to create, all to protect Israel. So what do they gain? You know, we know that Israel is their weapon in the Middle East. And like Biden said, if there weren't an Israel, we'd have to create one. We know they're racist. They don't see Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, you know, the jungle people of the global South as human, as Joseph Burrell would say. And it's also opportunism in service to this or that lobbying group. But I think that the most important factor speaks to this hyper-imperialist order that we've entered. And that is that October 7th meant is what October 7th meant to the Western imperialist project right now. You know, what Palestinians did in the Al-Aqsa flood operation, it struck fear into the hearts of Western leaders. They don't take kindly to indigenous people in the so-called jungle shooting at the garden. The collective West is backing the Gaza onslaught as part of a genocidal drive against the oppressed people of the entire global South. They're sending a message that this is what happens if you strike back militarily against their rotten, colonial, capitalist, hyper-imperialist system. Israel versus Gaza is the global North versus the global South, and I think everybody feels it. And, you know, we all know the imperialists have created this world where this small group of ruling elites in the imperial core, led by the U.S., very effectively steal from everyone else to maintain their hoarded wealth. And if this system collapses, they lose everything. That's why they sanction. That's why they overthrow. That's why they bomb. That's why they invade. They literally shorten lifespans as a matter of policy. And this system is so parasitic, they're willing to destroy the world if it means preventing its collapse. And Gaza is a microcosm of how far they're willing to go. Let's not forget, Gaza, in addition to being a concentration camp turned now into a death camp, it's also been a laboratory, and it is a laboratory, where Israel and its Western backers can test the most brutal methods of domination and control on those marked as unpeople. The people of Gaza were marked for death a long time ago. They were put on a diet, placed under siege, subjected to carpet bombing campaigns every few years, each one worse than the last. And those methods of domination and control have been exported around the world to be used on other marginalized populations to uphold this imperialist order. So we should consider this context as we watch Gaza face annihilation. We're entering an era of capitalism in crisis, of climate disaster, combined with this gradual decline of US empire, the most violent empire in history, which is terrified of the rise of China and Russia and is willing to risk nuclear war over it. And on a side note, I just want to point out that this is happening as we enter this emerging China that the US is so scared of. The resistance axis, as it's called across the Middle East, really wouldn't exist at this scale if not for the rise of a country like China. And what I mean by that is the resistance axis, it receives funding and arms from Iran. This is possible because of China. China's existence as an economic powerhouse that refuses to abide by U.S. sanctions on Iran has allowed the Iranian economy to access goods and capital it otherwise couldn't as a result of U.S. sanctions. So I just want to throw that out there. But back to October 7th, it triggered the collective West's worst anxieties. A bunch of brown people in the global South shot back at their plantation owners. And so they're not only practicing, you know, high-tech methods for obliterating a population, I think they're also setting a new precedent. In the near future wars of imperialism, it's going to be hard, I think, to match up to the horrors of Gaza. And as long as the next war isn't as bad as Gaza, it might be tolerated. You know, they're kind of expanding the goalposts of their barbarity. Even now we're seeing Gaza and we're saying, oh, it's so much worse than Iraq. It almost makes Iraq seem somehow tolerable by comparison. So we have to resist that conditioning. We should also be aware of the internal repression in the global North. I mean, this is a really mask-off moment. All of the sociopathic narcissism that underpins our dystopian global order is really on full display for everyone to see. The overwhelming, you know, first of all, they've made a mockery of international humanitarian law. They've killed any pretense of freedom and democracy that they claim to represent. And they're also turning inward to repress their own populations from dissenting against what's happening in Gaza. And the overwhelming majority of people across the global North actually support a ceasefire, yet they don't see this reflected at all in their leadership. So the anti-democratic nature of their own rotten countries is really being laid bare for them to see. And I think the repression is, it's going to get worse. And I think this is where the left is crucial as an organizing and radicalizing force, though there are other people on this call who are more suited to address that. But I do think we have a huge opportunity here. And, you know, before I wrap, I just want to talk about the resistance on the ground in the Middle East, starting with Yemen. It's the poorest country that just survived its own genocide, which was led by the U.S. and the Saudis, while the rich Gulf monarchies normalize with Israel and humiliatingly do nothing for Gaza. This poorest country in the region, Yemen, is blocking ships in the Red Sea to exact material consequences to pressure the U.S., Israel, and the U.K. to stop the genocide. And as a result, they're getting bombed and sanctioned and designated as terrorists, but they don't care because they feel this is their moral duty to resist imperialism. And we see it in Lebanon, we see it in Iraq, we see it in Syria. These popular political and military formations are standing up to Israel, standing up to the U.S. in solidarity with Gaza. And despite the consequences, you know, they don't care. Because they understand liberation means sacrifice. The loss in Gaza is huge. I'm not going to lie about that. It's completely devastating. It shatters the heart. It crushes the soul. But we can never lose hope, because in Gaza, every single day, there is a resistance that fights the Israelis and exacts casualties and consequences under the most difficult circumstances imaginable. They understand liberation means sacrifice, just like it did in Algeria, just like it did in South Africa, in Haiti, in Cuba, in China. You know, and all that's to say, we can't let these babies in Gaza die in vain. We cannot return to the status quo. And I just want to, you know, end by saying that, you know, we know the collective West, even with its waning power, is well organized and ideologically in sync, even if it's in the decline. So the question really becomes, and I think this is, you know, brought out in the important Tricon report, the question becomes, can the South and its allies in the West confront this moment? Because what happens in Palestine, it's not going to stay there. The horrors we're witnessing are in so many ways a lens into what these imperialists have planned for their adversaries in a lot of the world in the future. Thank you very much. And I look forward to hearing the rest of the discussion.
Thank you very much. That's Rania. She has a number of shows on Breakthrough News. Be sure to watch her dispatches. And of course, The Freedom Side with Eugene Poirier. Well, we've reached our final speaker, my favorite speaker. We're going to now have Jody Evans of Code Pink. Well, Code Pink was founded in 2002, 22 years ago, to lift awareness and build a coalition, a big enough wave within the United States to stop the hyper-imperialist machine, which was at the time conducting the illegal war against the Iraqi people. Jody, one war, another war, yet another war. You are always walking the halls of the U.S. Congress, banging on the door, telling them to awaken their conscience. I watched you last week, videos of you circulating along with your colleague Medea Benjamin, trying to force U.S. lawmakers to take a reasonable position on the complicity in the genocide against the Palestinians. It's such a great honor to have you here, Jody Evans of Code Pink.
Thank you, Vijay. And it has been so wonderful to listen to all of your voices from around the world. Very nourishing. As I say, good morning from the belly of the beast, or should I say monster? Yes, as Vijay said, I come after a week in the halls of Congress with my Code Pink team, witness to the rot at the core of the empire. Our intent was to stop the destruction of Gaza. The issue in Congress is a request to Biden to effect a ceasefire and end the bombing by their puppet Israel. We were also there desperately trying to stop the $14 billion more Biden wants to send to Israel, and our final request to refund UNRWA. At Code Pink, we really want the U.S. to recognize Palestine and end the 75 years of Israel's Zionist oppression and occupation, but there's no one in Congress carrying that request. Congress has a bunker mentality that is narrow in thinking, yet full of narcissism and hubris and bold violence. There are 435 members of Congress, 100 members in the Senate. Only 77 can even say ceasefire, and not even 20 have committed to end to say no to more money. The majority are white, male, and old. The Progressive Caucus of the Democratic Party, known as the CPC, is majority owned by AIPAC, the most powerful lobbying group in the Western world, American-Israeli Political Affairs Committee. A member and leader in getting the money to Israel, Congressman Richie Torres, a self-described Afro-Puerto Rican fighter from the Bronx, as he was walking for a vote, I asked him how he could not call for a ceasefire, and why was he sending more money as he watched a genocide unfolding where children were starving to death. He was trying to ignore my question and walk past me as quickly as he could, but he had this huge smug on his face, and so I asked him, why are you smiling while I'm asking you about a genocide? And he turned to me and said with force, because you're a buffoon. To which I responded, who is the buffoon? He ran away. Congressman Brian Donald seemed happy to engage in what he called a conversation, as long as he had the upper hand and I listened to his lies without interrupting. Hamas, he said, engaged in unspeakable war crimes on October 7th and continues to flagrantly violate the Geneva Conventions using human shields. This can end if Hamas surrenders. They refuse, so Israel has the responsibility to obliterate Hamas. This congressman is Black, raised in New York, but represents a conservative Southern Florida district and being considered as Trump's vice president. Congressman Brian Mass from Florida told us, do you know where we stand on terrorists? We stand on their throats. And Congressman Fleischman from Tennessee said he wants to wipe Palestine off the earth. Members would tell us off camera how frightened they were of AIPAC. Now that the terminology of ceasefire has been totally co-opted and weaponized by Biden and Harris, more members are willing to say it, but it has lost any meaning, as Biden just says things to appease with no intention of doing anything in any way to help Palestinians, even as he pays a high price with the voters and the people of the world. He just doesn't care. Progressive Democrats in Congress are lost in a panic between wanting to please their voters and AIPAC at the same time. Others are just happy to strut their full support of violence for their voters. Both totally missing that the U.S. bipartisan foreign policy elites are unanimous in their support of Israeli expansion. They need Israel as the Western flank against Asia. Those who see themselves as representing the needs of the people, known as the Squad, are also being targeted by AIPAC. Yet, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley, and Cori Bush had the courage to wear a keffiyeh to the State of the Union and held signs, stop sending bombs and lasting ceasefire now. One of our most disturbing meetings was with Congressman Rosa DeLauro, who had just returned from Israel and came from a meeting with Blinken and others in the White House. She spoke with full colonial mentality. The U.S. will decide who the good Palestinians are, who we will put in charge and tell what to do. She declared Hamas is gone. In explaining to us what was next, it was the same playbook as Iraq and Afghanistan. Take U.S. tax dollars, create a puppet government. The U.S. in this case, and Israel, controls and dismantle anything that was infrastructure from the past, which creates a constant resistance, which creates a never-ending need for more money, for more weapons from U.S. taxpayers. It was also depressing to see the number of women and people of color who have become the most ferocious defenders of the genocide. No one more ferocious than Victoria Nuland, who thank goodness left her position at the State Department, but only after managing to fully disrupt any semblance of peace globally. When they are not talking about more money for Israel, they are intent on getting Ukraine another $75 billion before Russia invades all of Europe, or in Biden's case, until the election is over. And I argued with many members of Congress, both sides of the House, who insist China is invading Taiwan by 2025 and has missiles pointed at every U.S. city. They must wage war on them first. They speak emboldened by the $1.5 trillion they spend on weapons and war each year, and their control of 75% of the weapons in the world, including the largest nuclear arsenal they're willing to use and insanely believe they can win wars with. Witness the fractured political farce in Washington carrying out an unabashed 18th and 19th century style genocidal rampage on the people of Palestine. To the horror of a majority of the voters, both the farce and the genocide, more and more are aware they do not live in a democracy, there is no one at the wheel, and they are headed off a cliff. A cloud of despair hangs over the heads of anyone in the US still thinking or feeling. And yes, most of them are robots. The toxic waste dump and circus that is Congress is a reflection of the evisceration of the education system, a media that is just a propaganda machine, and the war economy culture that most citizens are slave to that has little or no connection to the needs of life. The electoral system is a $4 trillion industry that sucks money away from the needs of people into a circus of faux democracy, distracting people from investing themselves in anything of real value to the health of the country, their communities, or their own lives. Congress itself lost in its own dance of accomplishing nothing, all while the state, the loose cabal that represents the needs of the elite, only wants one thing: the survival of the empire at any and all costs. Poisoning the world as it has poisoned itself and sucking all that is healthy or beautiful of life with it. The world saw how it works at the UN vote to stop the genocide. The one hand up in veto, it gets what it wants. All the rules are rigged in its favor. Almost everyone at the mercy of its needs, except for those who live with their lives in resistance. The monarchy of the US rules the world. The people are starving. The global resistance is growing as the court is debauched, insular, and stupid. The image of Biden eating ice cream cone while discussing a genocide is the perfect image of let them eat cake. For the world and for the people in the US, there is no victor in the US elections. The curtains have been pulled back for all to see. The emperor has no clothes. Now how to respond? We are watching a socialist education in flash times. Those I am in the streets with are learning so fast. They are willing to not accept the options they are offered and will not engage with the systems they see are broken, even if the next step is not clear right now. They are heartened by global outrage. They are learning from it and emboldened by it, feeling courage from those they witness abroad, beginning with the Palestinians, but including South Africans and all the other countries who have joined in resistance. The activists can feel the violence with impunity that is their hyper-imperialist government. Many speak about empires dying, and the witness of this one dying is horrific, as it flings its claws in every direction, willing to take everyone and everything down with it. But those in the streets are not flinching and moving forward into the unknown together. The comradeship is beautiful. It is what nourishes our broken hearts. The breadth of support is across social strata. People are learning from each other, old and young. Cultures are weaving. The skills of care, regeneration, and renewal of life are growing inside the movements. The connective tissue is weaving a strong bond of resistance. Onward to socialism and peace.
Thanks to Noor and Jody for their insightful words. That's all for this week's Code Pink Radio.
Learn more about urging your representative to say no to all supplemental aid to Israel by visiting codepink.org/congresstracker. You can also join us for local and online events every week, which you can find at codepink.org/events. Thank you for listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
sudden you think they're foes, they're in business together. Danny Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more. It's blood for oil.